City Harbor is wet. I take it that I'm expressing some pie state of one of these varieties.
Yeah.
So what about if I assert City Harbor is not wet?
Yeah.
Am I expressing a kind of pie state?
Yeah.
Or what am I
it's a more complicated one, which involves negation. I suppose I didn't talk about negation. But I suppose there's a functional structure that underpins negation, which is to do with, well, we'd have to play with theories, but I suppose it's the idea that I'm constrained from tokening pi. So there's a sort of sub-pi, the one corresponding to Sydney Harbour is wet or something. So it is wet. Anyway, Sydney is nice. Okay, there's call that delta. I am constrained. Actually, what goes on when I'm expressing Sydney isn't nice is that I've got a state which is constraining me from not tokening delta, where that constraint is generated by a specific kind of architecture involving things that underpin reason, ultimately.
Right, so what I want to know is what that architecture is. So
why?
So I didn't take it that the... I mean, you suggested the Fregi's problem is a problem of how making sense to talk about validity. But the way I see it, the problem is making sense of complex sentences in the first place. And you might say, look, if we're not in a theory of meaning, we don't need to give meanings for complex sentences.
No, there are meanings for complex sentences.
But if you're giving a theory of assertion, then it's got to apply to complex sentences as well.
Absolutely.
And one of the things you want your theory to predict is the same things that you want to predict. If you are giving a compositional expressivist theory of meaning, understanding expressivist theory of meaning, you want to explain why it is that asserting Sydney Harbour is wet and asserting Sydney Harbour is not wet comes
Yeah, well, fine.
So that's one of the things that your theory about this new fancy delta state is going to have to do.
Yeah, but I have to do that because
the same things
what's the fundamental
ordinary solutions to Fregi's problem are trying to do.
Yeah. Well, I suppose what I'm going to do is explain intuitions and dispositions to do certain things, like, for example, the horror of contradiction, right? So I go, Sydney Harbour's nice, Sydney Harbour's not nice. Oh, I don't like that. Maybe I'm Grand Prix, I kind of live with it, but... Late at night, I worry about it. What's going on? Well, it's because in one case, I'm expressing, as it were, defending delta. In the other case, I'm defending this, call it constraint on not tokening delta, right? And that's the psychological reality that's pushing and pulling me. I mean, and I suppose that's what part of what you explain through the theory of negation, I suppose. I mean...
It sounds just like Blackburn 1984, though.
But how? Tell me how.
What's that?
How?
Because he's given a story about what. So just like Peter McConnell, what they state the things for Deccan in asserting negation, he's given kind of what it is to think in negation. And he's got a story about why it is that thinking in negation conflicts with thinking the other thing. Is that is
Yeah, but I'm not trying to define validity as a kind of psychological conflict. It isn't.
I didn't ask anything about validity, I just asked. Sorry.
Or incompatibility. Incompatibility isn't a kind of psychological
follow up.
Oh, just that your answer explains why the horror of negation is localized in the small geographical area outside Australia.
Yeah. Okay, that's true. Right. Well, you changed your states, don't you? I don't know what how negation operates.
Michael Lynch.
Just wanted to know more about the linkage principle, Steve. I guess, in a sense, I'm trying to figure out what things have natures on your account and what things don't.
Yep.
And I guess numbers don't, right? Numbers are,
and I'd be happy
are
with
like
that.
Values, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's okay, that's cool. So, in fact, like all mathematical entities are the sorts of things we're not supposed to ask metaphysical questions about.
Oh, no, you can if you want to. Just all your answers will be false. About. Like, are numbers structures, are numbers sets of a particular kind, or are numbers...
Okay, all right. Well,
nothing wrong with those
statements. Okay.
No, but you want to say, well, which ones have...
Well, I guess if you're willing to sort of say that every question I ask about numbers, sets, functions, and so forth, everything like that, I would ask questions in are false. I'm not quite sure how to follow up on.
I suppose
exactly what I expected you to say, but that's okay. Maybe I can ask you, let me ask a little bit more about production. So what does it mean to say that there must be some place for that constitution to play a role in the production production, you mean calls for production, right?
Yeah.
So how about discussion about the itty bitty teeny tiny, and to use technical terms, from in physics, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So is it okay to ask about that?
Absolutely. Yeah. So this is the good question. I thought you were asking.
Yeah. So that's. But there's a real big
question.
Cool. Have any causal role to play in our...
No. Okay, I'm not against constitution generally. So here's the view of reality, I think it's this. That there's a reality of macro things, micro things, and there's constitution relations, of course. Big things like chairs and people and so forth, galaxies, they're constituted by stuff. Substances of various kinds are constituted by stuff and so forth. I'm not denying that. So you can ask, well, what is, water? That's fine. There's a question about what its constitution is. Okay. So there's plenty of stuff out there that has constitution in various senses of constitution. It's just the thought is that you get to a certain level, right? When you get down to, well, there are properties, let's say, or there are facts, let's say, simple states of affairs, let's say, and the question of, well, what is their constitution? It's not that they're primitively constituted, they're just without constitution. So the thought is, but where do we draw the line between the two? And that's it's an empirical question which is reflected in the structure of the language. And it's to do with whether or not the referents have an explanatory role in the talk, ultimately. Well, that's a bit simplified way of putting it. When we look at the talk about the referring terms for that chair or that stuff, then the referent in this case does have an explanatory role, though not the anything corresponding to a predicate like wateriness, let's say. It does. And so ultimately, that's why, to put it in simplified terms, for those cases, questions of constitution are okay. I suppose that... So the question is, well, when do you draw the line between stuff for which...
It sounded like you just gave me an answer. It's an empirical question.
Yeah.
To draw a line. So it's an empirical question whether there are... So we investigate, let's see, we investigate whether there's... quarks and so forth, and we find out, do they play a role in the production of my talk about quarks?
Yeah.
When we find out the answer is yes, we allow ourselves to go on and ask questions about what quarks are.
Yeah.
But it seems to me like we might need to know about quarks before we
no, no, but this
they are, before we figure out whether they play a role in production.
No, but I suppose there's a general, like a categorical thought that, generally speaking, the concrete is that for which we can legitimately, generally ask questions of constitution, and that's because... you could even say, though I don't want to put it this way, but our concept of the concrete ultimately reflects, partly this is the sort of the, what do you call it, the Eleatic,
yeah.
The shades of the Eleatic principle coming through here, which is that ultimately it turns out, empirical thought, the activity that underpins our material object referring terms is an activity in which the referents, particulars, right, have an explanatory role to play. And that's why nature questions are not eliminated in their case. Sorry.
Follow up by Mike Williams.
Yeah, I mean, in the case of most ordinary macro objects, does constitution just mean made of stuff?
Yep.
So there's no, like, cherry essence or anything?
No. So you can have...
Because it strikes me that most macro objects...
Cool.
So you... Right, and relationally so chairs are sitting on... spanners are for turning nuts, which are for fastening
yep.
bits of metal together, which are for blah, 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 blah.
No cherry essence, but there's a question about what constitutes a particular chair.
Constitutes, again, means like what a chair's made of.
Yeah.
Like wood. Some chairs are made of steel.
Yeah,
like,
pretty
what's the word constitution?
It means, I talk about it.
It's a weird thing to say. I mean, I don't go to the furniture store and say I'd like a chair that's constituted of wood, please.
I'm just talking about something.
I mean, I do think that we might think that water is constituted in a much richer sense by its molecular composition and structure. Now, I'm worried about what the word constitution is doing for you.
I suppose I just meant materially.
It seems to have thinner and thicker meanings, but then, if you think things are identified constitute as what they are functionally, then in a way I don't see why numbers aren't constituted by their place in arithmetic structures and so forth. I mean, I'm worried you're playing with the word constitution.
Yeah, I suppose I want to say this, that when we talk about arithmetic, when we, let's say, we talk about all the identity of a number. We say, well, what are numbers? You know, what are natural numbers? Oh, well, they're things that have succession relations and so on, and zero is a number, et cetera. Fine. I'd say that's fine. That's part of what we call... So I want to make a distinction ultimately between, you might say, oh, I don't like this, but identity. These things have identity and difference from other things. You know, number is different from, Frege, right?
Five is different from six.
Okay, so I want to say, look, there are these... They're not without identity. It's just I'm disputing this further question. But tell me, what is that thing? What's the nature of this thing that somehow underpins that identity? What are numbers such that they could have what's three such that it could be distinct from five in this way, the successor of two and so on. Merely just repeating, piano arithmetic at me won't answer that question. What I'm saying is that question, the best answer is to say, well, there's nothing to them. Right, you've got the identity, that's it. Is that the end of my question?
No.
Yeah. The further question is, but I want to know what makes that identity. It's this preoccupation with identity making, I suppose. You think, well, there's got to be something to the number such that will support these relations to other numbers, right? And one way to go is to go structuralist and go, oh, well, it's the relations themselves that have this constituting role. But that's already to, as it were, seek a kind of explanation of the identity, but through the relations themselves, relational constitution. But then that just leads to the question, well, what's this relation that's doing the constitution? What's constitutional relation and so forth? Whereas the view I have, or trying to have, is that actually you've just cut it out. You've got the language agency for the use of the numbers, and then you've got, as it were, an explanation of why it's intuitive to say the two, three is successor for two, and so on. But then the question of, yeah, but what is the number? The best answer is to say, well, either just to get worried and frown, but the informed answer is to say, well, it's without any constitutive nature. That's it.
Rachel. So this is probably on the same topic. So it seems like expressivism about X for you, where X is some domain, is going to have kind of two components. So one of them is going to have to do with explanations of my thoughts about X. What explains my thoughts about X? Not anything about reference to X's, but whatever cognitive science concepts end up getting used in kind of this cognitive architecture story. So that's kind of one.
Yeah.
One aspect of if I've got you right, like stop me anytime. I've got you totally.
Yeah, but it's not going to be a functional theory. It's not like functionalism. I'm not going to say, oh, thoughts are functional states.
Right.
It's a functional theory which will include a functional story about what goes on when you talk about thoughts, as it were, or meanings. Yeah, go on.
Right, but it's not going to include sort of my thoughts about X refer to X, and they have sort of inflationary meanings, that sort of thing.
Well, no.
Okay. So
it's meant to explain all your folky intuitions about what thoughts are.
So there's that aspect about sort of what my cognitive processing about becoming consistent, and then there's also this claim that there's no point asking questions about the nature of X, the fundamental nature.
Well, all the answers will be about certain a range of certain things will be just false.
Right.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. I'm wondering how much these two aspects of expressivism have to do with each other, because they would have looked intuitively to me like they were totally separable. So you might think, if I want to know sort of what thought about dogs consists in.
I'm not answering that question. It's a non-question. Not telling you what your thoughts about dogs consist in. I'm telling you what consists in the structure of the speech acts and the cognitive underpinnings that go on when you say that guy's talking about dogs.
Okay, sorry. Yeah, so.
No, but that's crucial.
Yeah, so I want to know what it is I'm saying when I say that guy's talking about dogs. So that's kind of one question. I think they should sort of go to philosophers and cognitive scientists to answer that question, and I'm happy with that. But then another kind of question is, what is the nature of dogs? And I don't want a cognitive scientist telling me what the nature of dogs is. I want a biologist or a veterinarian telling me what the nature of dogs is.
Well, fine. That question won't be undermined by the expressivism. Because
broadly
speaking...
I might be really confused.
No. Here's the thought. Okay, but here's the thought, roughly. And this is the connection with the original impulse that people go in, why they're going for expressivism. Right? And this is that somehow, when I tell you the expressivist story about how value talk works, okay... I say, well, it involves the expression of motivational states, da 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 da. All right, I tell you that story, and maybe I also include a story about, well, this is what goes on when you say this has goodness and so on. And then you come back to me and go, oh, fine, that's okay, but tell me what goodness is. Right? And if you insist on that question, tell me what goodness is, I say, you haven't understood me. On the other hand, when I give you the expressivist analysis of what goes on about dog talk and so on, da 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 da, you can say, legitimately, or there isn't just a dead end straight off, well, what does a dog consist in? Like, what's their biological nature? That's okay. One case it isn't, and ends in a dead end, well, what are values? The other case doesn't end in a dead end, ends in an empirical program. Okay, what's the difference? Here's the difference, roughly, a bit crude. In one case, in the case of the value talk, the referents of particular terms, i.e. the predicate good, for example, is eliminated in the explanation of the language agency. That's the ultimate reason why it is that when I give my expressivist analysis of what goes on when I use the good predicate, your question, but tell me what goodness is, the best answer to that is to say, has no nature. That's it. Whereas, when we use the referring terms, the plural one, dogs, or singular ones like that dog, referents, particular animals, are not eliminated in the explanation per se. I'm not saying that it's not a theory about meaning, but there is an interaction potentially with dogs, and that comes into the story. That's why, as it were, and that holds generally for the category of material things. That fact of which is actually reflected in a broader way of how we interact with the world when we use singular terms and plural terms of that kind, is ultimately the seat of our intuition. That there is something kind of there about the nature of dogs in a way that possibly there isn't in the case of values, right? That's why when you ask people, well, what's a value, they kind of go, oh, right? Or they think it's queer or strange. So that's, I don't know if that answers your question.
Okay, I apologize to the two follow-ups and to the two people in the queue, but we started 5 minutes late, now we're 5 minutes over, so let's simultaneously thank the speaker and welcome the next one.
Everybody at the center for organizing this, and today I'll be talking. I'll be talking about this. I've stuck more or less to the abstract, and that you know, there's been a fair bit of talk about. Pluralistic theories of truth in the last few days, and. You know, truth and representation are very closely related notions, and so there's always this question of where should the pluralism best be put, if it needs to go in just one or the other. And I'll start by sort of motivating a kind of pluralism in Michael Lynch's terms, and that's the sort of framework that we saw the most recently. And if you think about sort of attempts to give a sort of substantial account of truth, you know, the first and most obvious one is a sort of non-epistemic account of truth. This is, I'll call the indirect causal theory. This is, if you've read Michael's book or saw his talk, I refer to it as a causal correspondence theory. Right, namely, the belief that A is F is true if and only if the object causally mapped by A has property causally mapped by A, by F. that's a good way of getting at these sort of correspondence intuition. But as well known, this produces a number of scope or placement problems. Right, that it seems to work very well for tables and chairs, things with we bear something like an indication relationship with, but for things like numbers or values, they seem more problematic. And there's various ways of dealing with these placement problems, and Hugh talked a lot about that yesterday, so I won't go into it. But it seems that the indirect causal theory has a problem there. The other obvious or well-known candidate is the epistemic theory, and this is often, well, I'll be characterizing here as a directly epistemic theory. This is often referred to as something like super-warrant, right, that the belief that P is true if and only if it is warranted without defeat at some stage of inquiry and would remain so at every successive stage. Right? This also deals nicely with a lot of the cases that the indirect causal theory doesn't deal well with, but still comes into scope problems of its own. Right? It sort of seems well-suited for topics where we think everything should be epistemically accessible. Where that's not the case, it seems to go wrong. So claims like, say, it rained here a million years ago, that seems to be a fact of the matter about that. Would like it to be true or false. But it might seem that that's neither super warranted or not. And so one natural response to think, well, you've got this theory that deals with some cases and this theory that deals with another, is to be a pluralist, right? That you can say, well, there's just two types of truth, and I will not be giving the details here, right? That there's there's simpler, more complex ways of doing it. Michael has one of the more complex ways. But the basic idea is that the truths can be divided into two groups, the bits for which the indirect causal theory works and the bits for which the direct epistemic theory works. Right? And so just those are the theories again. And so the pluralist hopes to sort of get over the scope problems by just partitioning the class of truths into two. And that's, you know, that's nice. The pluralist theory is a nice theory in a way, but it's also a weird theory in a way. And it's and that's partly, I think any kind of pluralism about truth can seem weird just in that truth doesn't seem to be plural. But I think there is something especially weird about Michael's pluralist theory here at that time. That the two types of truth are different along two different dimensions. Right? That it's not just that you have the causal notion of truth and the epistemic notion of truth, but as the name suggests, one notion of truth seems to be direct and one is indirect. Right? That in fact there are sort of four corners and only two of them being picked out, and the two that have been picked out don't naturally fit together. Right? So that one might think that if you were looking at the kind of causal account, there are two types of causal theories. There are many, many types of causal theories, and I'm just working on the sort of standard indicator one. But there's the kind we've looked at, right? Which is, well, I won't read again. You've seen already. This, in some sense, builds in two components, right? That there is, you have a general sort of compositional principle, which gets a lot more complex than this, but this is something which the kind of thing you would think of as finding in a descriptive semantic theory, and then a kind of meta or foundational semantic principle that explains how the terms get the values that they do. Right. So for a teleological theory, it would be one way. If you had a causal theory, you might have something like sheep represents sheep. It's the same as sheep cause under appropriate conditions. Mental tokenings of sheep. And this isn't supposed to just work for sheep, right? This is something which will apply to other terms as well. Okay, just so that's clear. Okay. So that's the indirect causal theory. Okay, and but the alternative direct theory would be not working through the actual semantics, but just saying something like the belief that P is true if and only if it causally maps the fact that P. Right, that you don't work through the descriptive semantics. You just think there's a causal relationship between beliefs and facts. This is something which we, is a basic correspondence intuition, but that kind of direct theory has been pushed out by indirect theories recently, and for good reason. Right, so you have the direct and indirect causal theories. The same thing with the epistemic theories. Right, though once again, with the epistemic theory, we started with a direct theory. Right, but one could have a corresponding indirect epistemic theory as well. Right, something on the order of the belief that A is F is true if and only if the object epistemically mapped. Right, if you had some notion of an epistemic mapping that's doing the work that the causal mapping did in the indirect causal theory. Right, and so that, in the same way, would have two parts. Right, you'd have the standard descriptive semantics, and you just have a different kind of foundational semantics behind it. Right, so something like, say, artwork represents artworks if applications of artwork to artworks is warranted without defeat at some state of inquiry and would remain so, and so on. And once again, not just for artworks, this will apply generally for all the kinds of terms that the epistemic theory is supposed to work for. Right? So you have these two types of theory, and you've got the quadrants here. The kind of pluralism we've seen so far deals with these two, right? And this is, and one would think that a less weird pluralist account of truth should be, either moving up and down here or up and down here, right? It's possibly just a sort of preference, but in some sense, there's a natural sense of pluralism about truth that would take both versions to be direct. Right? So there's some parts of language that are a kind of direct causal theory works for, and some kinds of direct epistemic theory works for. Since those individually aren't that appealing, especially the direct causal theory, it's not surprising that Michael's moved to something like this, right, where you've got the indirect causal theory, which is dealing with the causal metasemantics and the compositionality principle, but still takes the epistemic account as being direct. And one thing I'd like to initially consider is, what if your pluralist takes the either side to be sort of more symmetrical, right? That you take a indirect epistemic theory, deal with something like a warrant running through compositionality to give you your account of truth, right? This is, I think, a natural pressure that comes up. If you start thinking about truth directly, especially for the causal cases, very naturally pushed towards an indirect theory. But once you've got an indirect theory in one part of your plurality, it's natural to make it symmetrical and have an indirect theory in both parts. And just to sort of fill in the familiar figures where these would be coming out from, you'd think of something like a Rawlsian account of how the ethical terms come, or something like Dretsky for your other terms. And it's sometimes being talked at, I think, the intuition that something like one half is giving you something like E representations, the other half something like I representations. I don't think it actually works that way, but it's a tempting way to see these things as mapping together. Right? But this kind of pluralism is going to push you very quickly to think of the real pluralism about representation, not about truth. Right? So that you've got this view. The compositionality principles are the same in both, right? That it's natural to think you just have two different notions of representation, both being plugged into the semantics, which then give you the two types of truth, right? And especially given that most of the sentences involving the ethical terms will involve terms which themselves are better suited towards the more causal picture. Claim about a beautiful sunset is mixed in a way. And once it's pushing this way, it's hard to see why you really need a kind of pluralism about truth at all, right? That in some sense you just have a more generalized indirect conception of truth, right? That belief that A is F is true if and only if it's the object mapped by A has a property mapped by F. And it's just that there's two different ways the terms get mapped, right? The representational pluralist might argue, well, there's terms like table and chair that have a kind of causal mapping, and there's terms like beautiful or just, which have a kind of epistemic mapping. And you can, if you want to be a pluralist, I think you're going to feel a push towards doing things this way. And there are, and this is a, I guess I'm describing a series of pushes I've been feeling, that if you, once you are pushed this way, right, that you think you've got a language where, you know, you've got a kind of Dretsky semantics for part of the terms, a sort of more Rawlsian semantics for the rest, that's nice, and it has a number of advantages over other kind of the more direct pluralist account. Some of those reasons, I won't go into any of them into too much detail. So one is less weird. I think that's just a personal reason. I recognize that weirdness is a, different people have different intuitions about what is weird, but I think the theory which has both direct or both indirect is less weird than, I think, a theory that mixes them up. But that's maybe a matter of taste. Deals much more easily with the mixed inferences. Right? Obviously, if you are, this is something, once again, I won't talk about because Michael talked a lot about that yesterday, but if you are a pluralist about truth, mixed inferences cause a lot of problems. And Michael has given a story about how one can try to deal with those problems, but it's better not to have problems than deal with them. And if you're pluralist about representation, you don't have that problem, right? That you've just got one notion of truth. These inferences work more smoothly that way. Lastly, I think it deals better with what I'll call sort of complex sentences. And complex sentences are the kinds of sentences where the differences between the direct accounts and the indirect accounts become more salient, right? So you can have simple sentences like, say, this is a beautiful sunset, or it's raining right now, right? And these are ones for which both the direct causal account for rain one seems to work okay, and the direct epistemic account seems to work fine for this is a beautiful sunset, right? That they, the kinds of things that the compositional account and the direct account are going to say are about the same, right? But it's noteworthy that they can come apart with certain sentences that seem more complex, like it was raining on the spot a million years ago, right? This is one which, the direct causal account has a little more problems with, right? That it seems like if it's raining now, I can see myself intuitively as responding to that fact, to the extent that I can see myself as responding to facts. But causally responding to, the rain a million years ago is more problematic, right? As there's many kinds of things for which a direct causal account doesn't work for. And in much the same way, and that's the motive for going from the indirect causal theory. The same thing is going to be true for the epistemic theories, right? So that you can have a claim like there was a beautiful sunset visible from this spot a million years ago, right? That is something which one hopes a indirect epistemic theory is going to capture, while a direct theory is not, right? That it's that we may have no reason either way to think, that's going to cause problems for a sort of straight superworn account in just the way that rain too is going to. Like, there's no real difference there. The fact that we're talking about a beautiful thing in the past doesn't make a difference, right? But at the same time, since we are talking about something. Unlike rain two, where some people might think, well, you can take a direct causal account. Sunset two isn't tractable by a indirect causal theory either, given that talk about beauty is more in the warrant camp, right? And so sentences like sunset two are tractable in the indirect theories in the way that the direct ones can't capture. Right, and so the indirect theories have this advantage, but one noteworthy thing about this advantage is Rain 2 is a sentence we've seen before, right? That Rain 2 is, you know, one of the standard counterexamples to why one might think that superwarrant was not great as a global account of truth, right? And I think Rain 2, you know, can be a problem. But if you look at things this way with these, you know, four quadrants, the question is, you know, with Rain 2 and superwarrant is the problem that it's an epistemic theory or is the problem that it's a direct theory? Right? And I think if you look at the comparison with things like Sunset 2 and the direct causal theory, there's some thought that the problems with sentences like Rain 2 for a sort of standard superwarrant account has to do with it being a direct theory, not with its being an epistemic theory, right? And that the sort of pessimism about epistemic accounts as global accounts of truth might have been, in that sense, premature, right? So another sense in which one can feel the push is from this sort of not only a monism about truth, but now a monism about representation, right? That you can now have the, going back to the indirect epistemic theory, which we had before, no difference now, right? Same compositionality principle, but while before I was talking about artworks, you might think, well, no, here we can actually also plug in sheep, right? And once again, not just sheep, right? That something like a superwarrant account of what sheep are, right? So something represents sheep if the application of sheep is warranted without defeat at some stage and would remain so, and so on, is going to work for just as much for the non-evaluative part of the language. And this kind of epistemic account, once it's put in a compositional framework, isn't subject to the kind of worries about sentences like Rain 2 that the direct theory had to face. Okay, so if you look at the account we had then, it looks like the cases that we might have thought we needed something like causal for can, in fact, be incorporated within the warrant account. And so then you move more to a monistic account of representation. Right? This is a something which would be nice. And monism is nice, but I'm it's not to say you've got a sort of Rawlsian account of everything, but well, in a sense it is a way you can say you've got a Rawlsian account of everything. But that basic shape of the account is an account which independently you see offered by people like Tyler Burge or John Hoagland as a general account of semantics. Right? This is not a people who are independently thinking about how to formulate these meta-semantic issues will often come up with theories that look a lot like this anyway. Right? So it's not this existing framework is there. And while it is sort of monistic, it's still very much away from the e-representational picture. At the same time, I'm not entirely convinced this is going to map on completely to Hugh's notion that you've just got I representations all around. That would be nice. If it were, I'd like to be a good guest. But I'm still not sure about that, though maybe I will be in an hour or two, right? So that you've got this basic foundational semantics, and this is said all over the place, but I'll be probably drawing most from the version in Tyler Burge's Intellectual Norms and the Foundation of Mind, where you think of the use of a term as evolving. There's some items that are in its putative extension, some beliefs or commitments that make up the putative concept. Right? That's what we've got at any given point. And what we do is try to play these off, you know, both internally and against each other to reach a kind of equilibrium. Right? And once we've done that, then you get the actual extension or the actual concept. Right? And in the terms we were talking about before, right, in some sense, the tensions between these two are the things that upset the warrant of either an application or a belief. And once you've actually gotten these things in harmony, that's when you get to a point where things are going to be something like super warranted. Right? So that you've got this kind of more inferential sounding semantics. Though it's one which is going to also touch a theme that we talked about yesterday, you know, for lots of terms, build in something that's going to look a lot like an indicator account, right? That when we talk about you know, giving authority to the objects, right? That's something that is can be made internal to this kind of account, right? That it's how things are traded off between items in the putative extension and our commitments is something internal to our use. And for some terms, more obviously scientific terms, the items in the that we're actually applying the terms to and the structures we can discover inside of them play a lot more weight than they do for other terms. Right? And so I think there's a way of building in something about the fact of how different parts of the language behave differently on this model. But it's a model which is still a substantive one, which is what brings us back to the bifurcation thesis, right? That the, you know, this kind of epistemic model of representation is, you know, is more forgiving than the indicator model. Right? It's more forgiving than what you got when you thought just in terms of what an E representation was. Right? That the kind of causal informational account is that caused all the placement problems is a very prudish account of representation. And a prudish account of representation is tough, and one would like it to be a little more promiscuous. But, I mean, promiscuity can only take you so far, right? I think it's, at some level, one might think you don't want to let just everything in. And that's part of the worry I have with the actual notion of I representation is it does seem to let lots and lots in, right? That this is, though it's something which I'm less clear on, but in claims like, right, if we can explain how natural creatures in our circumstances naturally come to speak in these ways, there's no further puzzle about placement, right? That's a that is a notion of representation that I think is a little more forgiving than the notion outlined here, right? In particular, it's a instead of an emphasis on practicality, which you have here, the epistemic count has a sort of success condition on representation that you actually hit a kind of equilibrium, right? And this is something that is not obviously going to happen, right? That you can get a kind of bifurcation thesis coming back. It's just not going to be driven on ontological grounds, right? That there are the kind of causal or indicator semantics produced a kind of bifurcation thesis and placement problem just because certain objects were not there to be matched. This one is going to have, instead of a sort of ontological ground, more of a sort of epistemic ground. Right? There's some terms, for instance, but maybe when you bring them together, you're just going to have the extension reduced to zero, right? And that's which will produce a kind of error theory. Right? In some cases, that's fine. Right? That's what we've done with stereotypically, a term like which we might have made that coherent partly by shrinking the extension all the way down. But getting to a zero is a kind of equilibrium. The sort of real worry is what you might have with something like confused or inconsistent concepts, right? Concepts where the basic parts just don't seem to, you can try to bring them together, but it just doesn't happen, okay? And that's... I like graphics and PowerPoint, but that's all you're going to get today. Some confusion. You know, some things may just not be able to be brought into a kind of equilibrium, right? And it's an open question how widespread that is. One would like to think this never happens, and we try to not make it happen. But you know, there is room for something which I think. Bob called in another context a kind of semantic pessimism, right? A sort of worry that these things aren't going to be harmonized in the right kind of way, right? And in which case, those tracts of the language won't be representational, right? And you've got some people, I think there is a strand in, for instance, William James's work, where he talks about a lot of language as essentially instrumental and not representational, and is tied to precisely this kind of semantic pessimism. Right? This shows up less in pragmatism itself, but if you read the pluralistic universe lectures, right, they're tied very much to this worry that all of our concepts are deeply inconsistent, and it's a kind of inconsistency that we can't really repair. Right? That what, you know, what playing around with the logic does is push our concepts in ways that make that deep inconsistency manifest. And James is someone who has pessimistic moods and optimistic moods, but in his pessimistic mood, he is definitely a semantic pessimist. Right? He thinks that our concepts just have internal inconsistencies that are just out of our reach. Right? And if you happen to believe that for a term, then that term is going to be non-representational. Right? So that you have this epistemic notion is fairly forgiving, right? But it does leave it open a possibility and a real possibility that certain tracks of the talk may turn out to be representational. And it makes that possibility in a way that sort of tracks it, I think, a little better than some of the ontological worries, right? That this is, explains why worries about whether we're really talking, when we talk about ethics, is for a lot of us a more robust worry than similar worries about mathematics, right? That the sort of ontological source of the worry seems equally problematic in both, but the mathematical talk seems, if you don't look at it too hard, fairly well behaved, while ethical talk has a lot of seemingly irresolvable disagreements showing up all the time. Okay, so you have this possibility for a kind of pessimism, a kind of bifurcation, but it's one that is a different kind of problem on this account, right? That in some sense on this account, on the epistemic account, which at a certain level is a pragmatic account, it's a the bifurcation thesis is a practical problem as much as it is a theoretical problem, right? If you think of bifurcation or representationality as being purely ontologically driven, your discourse is representational or it's not. And if you find out that it's not representational and are unhappy with the way that pans out, well, there's nothing you can do about that, right? That being unhappy with the fact that you have to understand a certain range of your discourse as instrumental isn't going to bring any objects into being, right? I think the extent to which you are happy with viewing tracts of discourse as instrumental or non-representational in various ways will affect the kind of equilibrium you're willing to come up with in that discourse as well, right? That in some sense, representationality is a kind of achievement, and it's one which didn't need to say that twice. Representationality is an achievement which has to do, in some sense, with the cost we associate with non-representationality in various areas. But it's a cost which we typically find is very heavy, right? That I think one can think of a realm of discourse as actually being truth apt, you know, only if it is really representational. But it's clear that a lot of our discourse, in that sort of obvious ways, is truth aspirational, right? It aspires to be true, and we try to make those aspirations satisfied, right? And this is something we can play around a lot with, right? That I think the it's not entirely out of our hands to make it. We often will sort of, I think, massage a kind of discourse to bring it into a representational line, right? That we don't typically just give up when we find what can seem like a fairly robust inconsistency, right? An example of a kind of robust inconsistency, I think, is, you know, one that should be familiar to all of us, right? I know I have a hand. I don't know I'm not a brain in a vat. If I don't know that I'm not in a vat, then I don't know that I have a hand, right? There's a familiar tension between these three. There is a easy way to deal with this tension, right? You can say, well, Knowledge talk is not representational. They just don't fit together. That's I can tell a story of why it's useful to say things like one and two, and but you can tell a story of how knowledge talk works without needing to make these consistent in any real way, right? You can tell why, you know, we have these certain general principles, and we are inclined to say things like one and two. In the wrong context, that inconsistency becomes manifest, but you know, normally not in these contexts, and we just sort of don't worry about it. That's a fine pragmatic story about how you could tell about how knowledge talk works, and that can be treated as non-representational. But we typically don't do that. Right? That's a you know, we often will try to make it consistent by giving up one or giving up two, sometimes even giving up three, or more often these days, give a sort of explicitly contextual account which shows how really, in every context, this is consistent. Right? A contextualist account or a relativist account are all ways of bringing things into a kind of more complicated equilibrium. Right? That every time you add an index, you know, a range of equilibria become available that might not have been visible before. And you know, there's a certain sense which you can feel this tension between what is worth treating it as non-representational or treating it as having all these indexes, right? That it's, and some people will have a sense that, you know, being a full-on relativist can patch over a lot of inconsistencies and still treat the discourse as, in this sense, representational. But that's a and I think given that we are true aspirational, that kind of relativism is going to seem tempting in a way. But it's, but I think it is an open and in some sense a pragmatic question which way we want to go for some of these complex cases. Right? That it's there's a ton of repair work philosophers can always do to make things that seem hopelessly inconsistent consistent. Right? And that you can do a bunch of repair work, come up with replacement concepts. There's plenty of activities that indeed make up a large chunk of our professional lives that have to do with, in some sense, making, I think, problematic discourse representational. Right? That it is a achievement, and it's an achievement which I think philosophers often help us achieve. Though it's maybe an achievement which some of us philosophers are too committed to. Right? That it may be that if we can get a story of how treating it as non-representational is not so bad, that all this extra work to make it representational may seem like work that is best left undone. So I think the hard cases are two different ways to go, and it's and which is the best way to go is probably not going to be clear until you've actually gone both ways. So that's a bit of a pluralism about method, I think, is going to be required here. So just to wrap things up quickly, the three sort of main points is, I think, that pluralism about truth seems less appealing if you also like indirect accounts of truth. But I think an indirect account of truth pushes that truth pluralism to a kind of pluralism about representation in a fairly natural way. Second, that the global epistemic accounts seem more appealing as indirect counts than they do as direct theories. And finally, the bifurcation thesis survives to function on such accounts more as a problem for us to fix than as a fact that we simply have to deal with. So, thank you.
Clearly descriptive by the lights of the the bifurcation thesis in the sense that we've been talking about. And maybe some of the examples that talk about the past might be like that, where the problem about equilibrium comes from the fact that unavailability is overall kind of evidence, not for anything that looks like, in the old sense, the sort of failure of the descriptive character of the discourse in question. So that's just one thought. The other thought was that whether or not this attempt to draw a bifurcation lines up with the old one, it might prove not to be a bifurcation, but to be a kind of matter of degree for some of the reasons that I think that the old one does, namely, in particular, that the Ruffon consideration might count as a reason for thinking that nothing passes this test kind of absolutely, because we can never rule out the possibility that, as it were, what looks like equilibrium is going to break down due to a failure of a tendency to go on in the same way.
I think that's right. Like, I think these are not going to, two parts will not line up exactly, in that there is a